riders of the storm. Into this house we're born, into this world we're thrown, like a dog without a bone, and actor out alone, riders on the storm.
Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, has a coded message been found within the molecules of life, deep within the DNA in each cell of our bodies? Well, my guest Greg Braden believes through a remarkable discovery linking biblical alphabets to our genetic code, the language of life may now be read as the ancient letters of a timeless message. In a moment, my guest, Greg Braden, on Coast to Coast AM. New York Times best-selling author Greg Braden has been a featured guest for international conferences and media specials exploring the role of spirituality in technology. A former senior computer systems designer for Martin Marietta Aerospace, a computer geologist for Phillips Petroleum, and a technical operations supervisor for Cisco Systems, Greg is now considered a leading authority on bridging the wisdom of our past with the science, medicine, and peace of our future. His journeys into remote mountain villages, monasteries, and temples of times past, coupled with his background in the hard sciences, uniquely qualify him to bring the benefit of long-lost traditions to the forefront of all our lives today. From his groundbreaking book, Awakening to Zero Point, to his very pioneering work in Walking Between the Worlds and the controversy of the Isaiah Effect, Greg Braden ventures beyond the traditional boundaries of science and spirituality, offering meaningful solutions to the challenges of our time. Back on Coast to Coast after a 2.5-year hiatus, Greg Braden. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Well, good evening, George. I'm doing very well, and it's a pleasure to hear your voice, a pleasure to be here this evening.
Likewise, too. Time goes by quickly, does it not?
Well, it does. We've been off on a journey researching the material we're going to talk about tonight, and I'm just so very excited. It's exhilarating to be able to share the kinds of things we're going to speak about tonight.
A coded message found within the molecules of life. Tell me about that.
This book, the title of the book is The God Code, and what this book is about is a research project that actually began in the last years of the Cold War when I was an engineer working in the defense industry. And the thinking of myself, my colleagues at that time, we had a strong sense, a personal belief that we as a species are here as the result of an intentional act. That it's although we may not understand that it's no accident that we're here. And if that turns out in fact to be true, then it stands to reason that at some point in our past we would have been left a key or a clue or possibly a code that would help us to understand our relationship to one another, to our world, and possibly something beyond. And with that understanding, George, perhaps we would never find ourselves in the Cold War again.
Well, when you say that we were intentionally designed, intentionally created, did you come across any scientists along the way, Greg, that would have tried to refute that, who simply say, no, this was not intentional, it just happened?
Well, you know, there certainly has been in the school of thought of evolutionary biology, there are some people in that school that believe strongly that we're here purely by chance, purely by accident, and they cite evidence such as bacteria coming in from rogue asteroids slamming into a primordial soup of the Earth several million years ago, initiating the process that has led to life as we know it today. And while that certainly can happen, and nothing has ruled that out to this point, at the same time, George, those scientists admit openly, many of them in the open literature, that the complexity of life and the order and the organization that has led to the world as we see it today seems to be in Francis Crick's own words, almost a miracle. And that there appears to be an intelligence underlying that. And that's one of the reasons why this discovery, I think, is so very, very exciting, because it certainly points to a higher order or a high magnitude of intelligence underlying the very code of all carbon-based life.
I always tell some of those scientists, Greg, that even if the theory of panspermia is accurate, and if that's true, if that's what helped jumpstart life on this planet, for instance, that still that does not negate the fact that there was some intelligent design behind that.
Well, precisely, George. And as a matter of fact, while the book was being written, this research project began in the late 1980s. It wasn't until the release of the human genome publicly in the year 2000 that we were able to actually test some of the theories leading to the numeric link that allows us to tie DNA to the ancient alphabets. We're going to describe this as we go through the evening.
Let's go back just a little bit.
Sure.
To your book called The Isaiah Effect. Of course, the one we're talking about now is the brand new one called The God Code.
Yes.
But The Isaiah Effect has some kind of a tie-in to this if one believes in the long-term push of this entire message. When you started researching that on the Dead Sea Scrolls, did you come across anything that began to become a little baffling for you?
Well, George, I'll just say that most of my adult life has been devoted to, in addition to the hard sciences, to researching a wisdom that, while very ancient, is far from obsolete. And where we began looking, where I personally began looking for that wisdom, were in the external text, temple walls, the monasteries, and in texts such as the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the answer is, while our ancient understanding and science as well is as good as they appear to be today, the best scholars and the best scientists will tell you that what we know is incomplete. And it's in going back into these libraries, such as the Dead Sea Scrolls, that we're able to flesh out and make more complete what we know. And the answer is yes. In the scrolls themselves, we find references to a wisdom that Western science has only begun to make sense out of and understand in about the last 13 years. So we certainly see evidence of that information there. What we're looking at, George, is it appears that those who have come before us understood the complexities of our world in a way that perhaps we're only beginning to understand again today. They described it in a very different language. And if we can allow ourselves to cross the traditional boundaries that science uses to separate our world and, in fact, marry the ancient wisdom of the natural processes with the knowledge that we know today, the fruit of our willingness to do that carries us light years beyond what we've understood in the past. And I think that's probably one of the great benefits of what a discovery like this shows. In addition to the discovery itself, it's our willingness to cross those traditional boundaries is leading us into some of the answers to some of the greatest mysteries of our kind.
When were the Dead Sea Scrolls found?
The scrolls, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the mystery, we could spend an entire evening.
Six evenings.
Talking about the scrolls. They were first discovered in 1946, 1947.
Well, almost the same time as Roswell occurred.
Precisely. A lot of things happening back in the mid-40s. There were 11 caves discovered just outside of Jerusalem. In those 11 caves, between 1946 and 1959, over 25,000 fragments of papyrus and copper and animal hide parchment were eventually pieced together into approximately 900 scrolls, and those 900 scrolls became known as the Dead Sea Scrolls Library. They were and remain controversial because they are the oldest known records of both the Hebrew the Hebrew Torah and the Christian Old Testament, and they reveal many of the texts that were edited by the early church from the Christian text in the 4th century in the year 325 A.D. So it was those young scholars, initially, George, these 25,000 fragments of this material were given to a team of only seven male scholars, and those seven scholars were given the task of piecing these fragments together, of translating them, compiling them, and publishing, and it was only in 1991 that the content of the scrolls were freed to the general reading public through a microfiche collection at the Huntington Library in Southern California.
And that, what a task that was. Had the Dead Sea Scrolls, Greg, not been found, what would we be missing now?
Well, what the scrolls tell us, and as good as our biblical, Western biblical religious texts are, and they are good, the best scholars will openly admit that they are incomplete. It's not that they're wrong, it's simply that big pieces are missing. We look at the missing years of Jesus, and we wonder why they're missing, or we wonder why there aren't more books of women in the Bible. We know women were living there, and some of them were writing.
Sure.
Why don't we know more about them? When we read the book of Genesis, for example, in the beginning, not much is happening, and all of a sudden there's a world here, and it happens in about three or four sentences. And one of the reasons that is because the remaining texts that we see today, the Western biblical text, are a tremendously compressed, condensed version. So after, we know at least 45 books were removed. The term is they were not canonized into the Western biblical traditions, and they still hold valuable information. So, for example, we know there was not only Book 1, there was Book 1 and Book 2 of Adam and Eve talking to us about the origins of humankind and the physical location on Earth of where this garden originally was located.
Which some people believe was in Iraq, right?
Well, there are some in Iraq. They're looking at the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. There are other people believe is in Africa. And there are very clear clues that are given in these texts that really help to narrow that down. They're Book 1 and Book 2 of the infancy of Jesus, describing the life of a young man given abilities that those around him do not appear to have, and him coming to terms and learning the responsibility that comes with those abilities. So it's a fascinating stories. Those are the kinds of things that we missed, to answer your question, George, if we had not found these kinds of libraries. And along with the Dead Sea Scrolls were the oldest known records of the Hebrew Torah, the first five books of, subsequently the first five books of the Christian Old Testament. Right around the same time, another library was discovered along the banks of a little village in Upper Egypt that picks up where the Old Testament leaves off with the New Testament material that also was not canonized, and that library became known as the Nag Hammadi.
Yes.
For listeners that may not be familiar, Nag Hammadi. And when we put those two libraries together, we have what may perhaps be the best picture of what that ancient body of literature actually looks like, and within that, tremendous insight into our history, perhaps into the origins through the creation story, and some of the mysteries about what's happened in our past.
Through the Nag Hammadi, through the Dead Sea Scrolls, through the biblical texts that were passed on through Western-type civilization, do they all seem to center around and focus on something very mystical that had occurred on this planet a long time ago?
Well, it appears mystical to us. The way the texts describe what happened is perhaps less mystical. They simply state that that humankind, through a very mysterious process, that humankind is set aside, set apart from all other forms of life, and that we are given abilities given to no other forms of life, and that through those abilities, we are given the opportunity in the presence of one another to become better people and hopefully to create a better world from those abilities. And some of the texts, I'll just back up briefly. Just as the Christian Old Testament was edited and there were books that were not canonized, the same thing happened in the Hebrew Bible. There are books that were edited from the Hebrew Bible. Very interesting books. They simply were not part of the canonized version. One of those books is a book that's called the Agada text. And I talk about this in the new book as well. And it describes in tremendous detail the creation of the first of our species, as if an observer were watching the act actually unfold. So whereas in a Christian biblical text, in a few sentences, we see that we were formed from the dust of the earth and the breath of life was breathed into our nostrils and we became a living being. The Agata text goes on column after column after column for a number of pages describing the process of the creation of the first of our kind.
If you were to interpret all the various texts, all of them, what conclusion would you come up with?
Well, there are a number of conclusions, but I think the overriding theme, George, that we're left with is that humankind is a part of something perhaps much greater than we've ever allowed ourselves to imagine before. We are obviously a part of one another. We are a part of the life that we see around us, from the simplest to the most complex life, and a part of something much greater. And it's with that understanding, I think, we're given insight into perhaps our role, if you will, and the abilities that we have to participate, to not to control, and I'm going to be very careful about these words, not to control and not to manipulate, but rather to participate in the events of our lives and the events that are unfolding in our world as we speak today.
Did you come across anything in your research and work, Greg, which would have shown to you that mankind might have been genetically altered from some species that might have already been on the planet at the time?
I'll tell you, this is where it gets interesting, George. My background's in the hard sciences. And,
right.
And as a scientist, I've got to tell you, science can only tell us what has happened. They cannot tell us why. Science can look at the evidence and tell us what's there. The ancient traditions, although they may not be literally precise letter for letter, generally when stories linger and persist for hundreds of thousands of years, there's a kernel of truth, something that began those stories. So it's not so much in the ancient texts where we find that evidence, George. It's in the hard science. Now that genetics is blossoming into and developing into a full-blown science, genetic history, what our own science is saying to us is that, in fact, we each carry in the cells of our bodies the record of how we developed from the past. And what our own science is telling us is that we have genes and we have chromosomes in our bodies that are the result of an ancient fusion, a splicing or emerging that happened in our past that cannot happen naturally. So scientists cannot tell us precisely why or how it happened. Specifically, there was a conference in the year 2000, and it was regarding the origins of human chromosome 2. There was an entire conference, the National Academy of Sciences, looking at chromosome 2. And there were specific genes within the chromosome 2. And just to save the listeners from a very long story, the bottom line to these studies are that there are specific genes in chromosome 2, in human chromosome 2, that are the result of a fusion of primate chromosomes. And they fused in a way that cannot happen through nature. It cannot be through primates mating or any known process that we understand today.
Or Darwinism, I guess.
Or Darwinism. And what they, I mean, these are scientists telling us this. They, and I'll have the precise references right after we finish our break.
Sure.
About an hour. They are not certain as to how it happened, but they can tell us what happened. And it's the hard science that's saying to us, although we have a common genetic history with other life forms and other primates, something mysterious happened in our past that set us upon a path unlike any of the other primates, and we began, it appears, we began to walk our own path as a species. The fossil evidence now is beginning to support this kind of thinking as well, although the jury is still out. For example, in 1987, there was maybe some of your other guests have already spoken about this, and you can certainly stop me if they have, but there was an amazing, an anomalous discovery in northern Europe, George. There was the body of a Neanderthal infant, a young female Neanderthal, was found in the earth, preserved in a very unique way. She was not fossilized. She was not mummified. She was in a limestone cavern deep in the earth, and her body was carbon dated to about 30,000 years old. And she was so well preserved that her DNA was intact. And for the first time, we were able to compare Neanderthal DNA to modern humans. So we were able to compare the DNA of beings that we believe may, some scientists believe may have been our precursors or our ancestors.
Okay, hold that thought when we come right back, Greg, because we'll pick up from there, because there are some modern-day scientists now who are saying that the Neanderthals and the humans that we believe are us now might have been on the planet at the same time. We'll be back.
Coast to coast and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And our guest tonight, Greg Braden. His website is Greg, GREGGBRADEN.net. Greg Braden with two G's there, .net. The book we're talking about tonight, The God Code, The Secret of Our Past, The Promise of Our Future. And we'll be back with more with Greg in a moment. The After Dark newsletter, of course, the March issue is out. I love this one. It's on tsunamis. Of course, a lot of other stories are in After Dark, but tsunamis, that fascinates me. And what could happen if a volcano explodes in the Canary Islands? And could that affect us here in the United States? Couple ways to order the After Dark newsletter. One is toll-free, 1-888-727-5505. The other way is right on the coasttocoastam.com website. And yes, you still get, but the clock is ticking, my friends, trust me here, a free CD, one of Art Bell's interviews with the late Father Malachi Martin on exorcisms. Take advantage of it, because once this one's done, this CD will never, ever be reproduced again. And welcome back with our guest, Greg Braden. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. Greg, before the break, we were talking about this Neanderthal child that was found 30,000 years old, carbon dated, huh?
Well, precisely, George. And this is one of those instances. I am just amazed that this kind of information doesn't make a cover of, you know, Time Magazine mm-hmm. or USA Today, at least somewhere in the first couple of pages. But what happened was they found a very well-preserved body of this 30,000-year-old Neanderthal infant girl. She was not mummified. She was not fossilized. She was simply in a cool, dry environment deep in the earth in this cavern in northern Europe. It was the first time that a body this well-preserved had been found, and the first time that scientists could compare her DNA with modern human DNA. And if we, in fact, have evolved or descended from these seemingly lesser evolved forms of hominid, then it makes sense that would show up in the genetic record. And to the amazement of the scientists, I think, who were doing this, University of Glasgow in Scotland is where the work was done. And I've got a single sentence that summarizes the entire study. It was published in the Journal of Nature volume 404 in March 30th, the year 2000. In one sentence, they say the results of this DNA test between the Neanderthal infant and modern human suggests that modern human was not, in fact, descended from Neanderthals. So there was not enough genetic evidence to suggest that we were descended from them. As a matter of fact, there's evidence that we, as you mentioned before the break, that we actually shared the earth. That we walked the earth with these creatures at the same time. So we could have not have evolved or descended from them.
Where might we have come from?
Well, this is everything we're speaking about is as different as it might seem from the very first sentence at the beginning of this program. This is laying the foundation for why the message, the literal text message discovered in the cells of human DNA is so significant. Because all of these studies are showing that there's something about us, something happened in our past that set us apart from other forms of life, and we have been on this path ever since. While the book was being written in the year 2002, anthropologists working in northern Africa in the Olduvai Gorge area, where the Leakeys have done so much of their work, discovered fossilized remains of beings that look pretty much like us, George. We haven't changed much from the time that these fossils are dated now at about 160,000 years old. And this is one of the questions. If evolution is ongoing, you would expect that over those 160,000 years, their bones and our bones might look a little different.
Exactly.
For all intents and purposes, they're the same creature. Then we go back into the genetic evidence before the break at the bottom of the hour, and I promised I would have a reference because I know a lot of listeners like to look these things up. There was a conference. It was called The Origin of Human Chromosome 2 by the National Academy of Sciences, and this was October 15th, 1991. And the bottom line to that conference, they're saying that we conclude that this gene that they're looking at in chromosome 2, it's the relic of an ancient fusion and marks the point at which two ancestral ape chromosomes fused to give rise to human chromosome 2. So the scientists are saying, you were asking about what the texts were saying. The texts describe in words that something happened in our past that set us apart from other life. Science now is finding physical evidence that says precisely the same thing, although science cannot tell us why it happened. They simply can document what they have found in our past.
And it's too bad that Darwin did not have the luxury of DNA testing at the time, because I bet he would have come up with different conclusions than what he came up with a long time ago.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I use some of Darwin's work in this new book. People tend to use Darwin's theories and Darwin's quotes to support the beliefs that best work for their theories. And when we look at Darwin's work closely, Darwin was his own worst critic. And what he said, he actually said that he doubted that evolution all by itself could account for the complexity that we see in life.
Mm-hmm.
And he also said if something else were found, he says if one part of this theory falls apart, the whole thing, we've got to reexamine it.
It's like a domino.
Well, precisely. So it doesn't say that evolution did not happen, and in fact, in the fossil record, we see that it did. The question now is, can evolution alone account for the complexity that we see in life in general, and specifically for the human species? And this is where so much of the fossil evidence, the DNA evidence, are all pointing to the fact that something has happened. We don't know precisely what it is. Something happened in our past, and from that moment forward, we may not have changed all that much from the time of our original, from the time we began looking like we do now.
Take us out of the equation for a moment, Greg. Just take Homo sapiens out as if we didn't exist on this planet at any time. Were the Neanderthals the most advanced creature on the planet based on that?
During their time?
Yes.
We don't know the answer to that, George. Because, and the reason that I'm hedging on that a little bit is because we've got to ask ourselves, are we living a cyclic process? And has humankind been through this process in the past? And as we lay out the evidence of a literal code in the cells of our bodies. I'd like to talk more about the archaeological evidence.
Are you saying we might have been here prior to?
I don't know if it was us. I'm saying there's a growing body of scientific data suggesting that there have been tremendously advanced civilizations here in the past, and the reason we don't know about them now is because although they were spiritually developed and apparently technologically developed, they were still learning the lessons and the consequences of solving their problems through war.
All right, tell me more about this.
Well, this is some of the evidence. We're less than a month back from a trip into northern India, where archaeologists now are finding a growing body of evidence of a very advanced, obviously ancient civilization, possibly 6 to 8,000 years is what they're looking at. Although the evidence shows that some of these things may have happened way before that time. What they're finding are the remains of highly developed cities laid out on very precise mathematical grids, hot and cold running water, closed sewage systems, advanced forms of art, a highly sophisticated form of language that to this day has never been translated. So the people that were living in these cities, they told us something about themselves. We simply have not been able to read it yet. So the, number one, there's a mystery as to why these cities are there in a place and dating to an age where we aren't supposed to have that kind of sophistication.
How'd they find these cities? Were they buried?
Well, they were buried in late 1800s, early 1900s, all the way up through 1996 is when many of these the excavations are going on. Part of it is in the part of India that is now Pakistan. The division
Yes.
happened in 1948.
Okay.
So it's in the Rajasthan provinces north of Delhi, in northwestern India, and in northeastern Pakistan.
Also very difficult to get to, I'm sure.
Well, to throw a monkey wrench into the equation, the mysteries that are being found around these areas in the deserts are huge areas of desert sand fused into glass from a very rapid, intense heat. They're finding radioactive ash around many of the cities. The walls and the floors are vitrified, is the word that's used, exposed to high, intense heat.
Like nuclear?
Well, we don't know the answer to that. However, Russian archaeologists have, and I document this in the book as well, this is in the last third of the book, the new book, The God Code. Russian archaeologists have found human skeletons in the street level of these cities, of at least one of these cities, that are 50 times more radioactive than they should be.
Oh my!
Just from background radiation. So when we look at desert sand fused into glass and radioactive dust and ash covering an area about 4 square miles, we look at radioactive skeletons. Up until the mid 20th century, there was nothing that would describe anything like that, because we've never been able to read. The language, the name of the language is actually called Indus Valley Script. And to the best of my knowledge, as of a year and a half ago anyway, it had not been been translated. Usually, when we look into an ancient culture, George, and we find a myth that's been persistent for a long time, often there's a kernel of truth that began that myth.
I would agree with that.
That myth. So in this part of India, the only myth that goes back that far in time and describes anything, any ancient battles like this, is the Hindu Bible that is called the Mahabharata. If listeners are not familiar with the Mahabharata, the smaller section is called the Bhagavad Gita. I know many people are familiar with
mm-hmm.
that. And again, to make a long story brief, it describes two very ancient civilizations, spiritually and technologically evolved. They find themselves in one battle as part of a great war. When one side loses, they detonate a device that's never been used before, and they describe this in the texts. And the description has made very little sense until the 20th century. It describes rivers and the streams boiling from the heat of this device, and elephants bursting into flames in mid-stride, and birds turning to ash, falling from the sky, and humans losing hair and fingernails with this blast. We don't know what happened. All we can do is look at the evidence, we look at the myth, and we look at the archaeological evidence, And we have to ask ourselves, and this brings us right back to this message in the cells of our bodies, if we have been here before, if we have had technologically sophisticated civilizations as well as spiritual knowledge and misused that, that power, are we making the same mistakes again? And what can we learn from our past?
Maybe so. But no, you said this find could have been 6,000 years old of a city. Of course, the Neanderthals were here thousands and thousands of years before that. What proof, what evidence might there be that there were civilizations human-like before that?
Well, of course, okay, these civilizations are being dated, definitely dated 5,000 to 6,000, and some of the speculation is as much as 8,000 to 9,000. We've got archaeological evidence in northern Africa of advanced civilizations here prior to the last ice age, or at least during the last ice age,
which was 9,000 to 12,000 years ago.
9,000 to 12,000 years ago, right around in there. There's a growing body of evidence from other locations in Europe, northern Africa, also in Antarctica. The excavations going on in Antarctica underneath the Antarctic ice, which has been there at least since the last ice age. So we put all of these together. We haven't found the fossil evidence. We found archaeological evidence suggesting that we may in fact have been here and been at a stage of development much greater than we've ever acknowledged in the past. Cycled through, made the mistakes, lost the civilizations because, and this is the key to the whole conversation, because we couldn't find a way to transcend our differences, because we were solving our problems through war. And if that in fact is the case, the parallels between those times and what we're seeing happening now, it's hard to miss those.
Sounds
parallels.
Familiar. I've always thought with ancient archaeology, Greg, that I've always baffled myself that if they had high technology, where are the remnants of planes and television sets and computers? So here's a thought, and give me your feedback on this. What are the possibilities if beings with this kind of technology blew up whatever humans might have been on the planet at the time for some reason? Is that possible?
That certainly is what the myth suggests. If we're looking into the northern India scenario up in the Rajasthan province. However, George, since I left the industry and we began going into some of the most remote, ancient, some of the most rugged and pristine sites remaining on Earth today, from the monasteries in Tibet to the monasteries in Egypt and the Andes Mountains and Nepal and just coming back from India, there's a common theme that offers a different perspective. And what this theme suggests is that when a civilization gets lost in terms of who they are and how they relate to the world, when they lose their way, is the way it's described in the text, that they so long to have that connection again that they begin to build a very complex world around them, outside their bodies, reminding them through the outer technology of the inner technology that we have available to us. So from this perspective, the more complex a society, the more gadgets we build around us, the further we have come from that knowledge, that understanding of who we are. The flip side of that is that when we see these ancient civilizations and we're saying, you know, where are their VCRs and where are their toasters, it may be that we're actually looking at civilizations that were so evolved that they didn't need that very complex external technology.
That's
because
possible.
They had the inner wisdom.
That's possible. And I keep thinking of the ending of the Planet of the Apes movie when he wanders onto a portion of the Statue of Liberty buried deep in the sand. And I've always thought, if things like that had happened a long, long time ago on this planet.
Well, this is essentially the kinds of inner technology that are alluded to in texts such as the Dead Sea Scrolls and the mystical texts of the lost traditions, or the lost to the West anyway, and that we find in the Andes and in Tibet. What they show us, George, in their language, thousands of years old, it's been handed down over time, is that we have the ability from within our bodies to directly influence our physical bodies, and we know that now, quantum physicists are telling us that that effect extends beyond our bodies, that we affect the world around us through what we become within our bodies. That was the basis of the book, The Isaiah Effect.
And, you know, the Sumerian texts also back up many of the things you're saying right now.
Precisely, the Sumerian, the Babylonian texts, and even the many of the Aboriginal traditions that go back 26,000 plus years in Australia, continuous lineage, say something very similar. So while we are rediscovering in the West our relationship to the forces of creation through the study of quantum science, and scientists acknowledge that these relationships are there, they just don't know what to do with them. The ancient traditions and texts that we've studied, they not only tell us that these relationships exist, they say, hey, here's how you use them, here's how you apply them in your lives. And I think these are some of the great secrets why many of these texts were edited, and now that we're beginning to marry the two together, science tells us how it works, the ancient texts tell us how to apply what we found, and as we allow ourselves to marry those together, we empower ourselves and hopefully do become better people, and from that create a better world.
And of course, this leads us up to, of course, what we're talking about tonight, and that is the God Code, which you have uncovered. It has taken you years, I assume, Greg, to help uncover this code?
This is a 12-year-long research project. It is far from complete, George, and the bottom line to this project is that by crossing the traditional boundaries of the sciences and marrying the best science that we know with what the ancients say to us, a numeric link, a mathematic link has been found between ancient core or root alphabets in human DNA, allowing us to replace key elements, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, in the DNA with the letters of those alphabets. And lo and behold, not only do they spell words, they reveal sentences. And this is what our program's about tonight.
We'll be back in a moment and find out more about the God Code and what are these messages, because they probably affect all of us.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com. City of Angels, Premier Radio Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And what is this special numeric code that Greg Braden is talking about? We'll find out when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast is New York Times best-selling author Greg Braden. I'm George Norrie. Greg, some of the Egyptian sculptures that we've seen from days of antiquity that have animal heads, reptilian heads, and human bodies, might they have been an illustration of genetic engineering gone astray by any chance?
Well, you know, George, there's a lot of speculation that that's precisely what we're seeing. And the truth is, we've never found the mummified evidence of anything like that. We've seen references on the temple walls. I've spent for 18 years. I've been taking groups into Egypt, and we've seen some of the most ancient sites that we were speaking about earlier, pre Ice Age sites. And to the best of my knowledge, there have been no mummified remains of anything like that. So while they may very well be references, and we find those references in other cultures as well, we've not seen the physical evidence to support that.
I wonder
if any of your past guests, have they found any physical evidence?
Not as genetic engineering, but there have been some theories that perhaps they were visitors, like reptilian types.
Sure. Well, I think once again, I'm coming back to our topic for this evening. I think as we begin to understand more about this code in our bodies, it is a code that is found in all carbon-based life. That's life as we know it. And I think as we have the opportunity to sample, if we find evidence of life on some of the other worlds that we're looking at right now, and if it is carbon-based life, it's going to be very interesting to see if the code reads the same in those genetic sequences as it does in the ones that we have here in our world.
How did we break this code?
This is it's an ongoing project, George. I'll be very clear with the listeners. We are nowhere near complete.
Okay.
And I think perhaps the way to get into this topic is if I can invite the listeners to think about the cells in our bodies from a very, very different perspective, different than the way we were taught in school and the way our children are being taught today. When we look at a cell, we see this encapsulated membrane holding this sticky, gooey, protoplasmic stuff. And that certainly is one way of seeing the cells in our bodies. I'm going to invite the listeners just for a little while. If we can think of every cell in our bodies as a literal library, and the average body, we're told, has about 50 trillion cells. So we've got about 50 trillion libraries in our bodies. Each cell, we're told, science tells us that every one of our cells has 23 pairs or 46 chromosomes. If we can think of those chromosomes as books within the library, and those chromosomes are made of long strands of DNA, if we can think of those long strands as chapters within the books, and the long strands of DNA are made of little sequences, little sections that are called genes. And if we can think of those genes as sentences and paragraphs within the chapters, we're beginning to develop a very good metaphor for precisely the way this information is encoded into our cells. And just as at the beginning of nearly every book, before the first chapter, there is a foreword or an introduction. We appear to have the equivalent of that in our cells as well, and that introduction is the subject of the book, The God Code, and it's what we know for sure exists in our cells right now. So the message in our cells appears to exist in many, many, many layers. All of the layers only one layer has been translated and decoded. Now that we know how it works, the algorithms are being developed to take this to the next level. So tonight we can talk about this very first layer, and the fact that this message is there is mind-boggling beyond belief. What the message says takes that to an even greater magnitude, and that's what I'd like to talk about for this next little segment here.
Now, though you say this is an ongoing research project, how did we find the beginnings of this message?
There is a there's a story, George, about an archaeologist. His name was Heinrich Schliemann, who read the book The Iliad by Homer.
Right.
That was believed to be a metaphor by the scholars of his time. No one took it seriously, so they didn't think that Troy ever existed. And Schliemann simply asked the question. He said, "What if the book The Iliad is a literal description of this city? What would happen if I interpreted it that way?" He did that. He found himself on a mound of earth, and he excavated nine levels, nine different cities, and on the ninth level, he excavated the gates of the ancient city of Troy, and all he did was follow the instructions that were left by those who had come before him. And I'm using that as an example, because in a very similar fashion, What I did was I went into very specific texts, some of the most ancient and mystical, some of them so mystical they're not even well received in Western traditions. I looked at the clues that were left as if they were literal clues and began applying the best science of our time to understand what those clues might have been saying. By crossing those traditional boundaries, it led to the numeric links between the ancient alphabets and the modern way of looking at our world.
Okay, explain that a little bit more for
us. Okay, the Western science today tells us that our world, our universe, our world, our bodies is what it is because of an alphabet that we call the periodic table of elements. That everything is what it is because one or some combination of those elements, carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, zinc, boron, you know, it goes on and on.
All the way down.
Everything in our world, science says, is what it is because of those elements. The ancients, and I'm going to be very specific here, began looking at ancient biblical Hebrew, and I can talk more later on about why we chose that language. But ancient biblical Hebrew says the same thing, except instead of the periodic table of elements, it says that the universe, our world, and our bodies were created by the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. To a scientist, that makes no sense whatsoever.
Okay.
Unless those letters are actually representing something else. Well, with all of the elements in our periodic table, we have a name and we have numbers associated with those names. And in a similar fashion, George, and a lot of listeners may or may not be aware of this, as I began the research, I was surprised to find out that every alphabet, every language known today, has with it, in addition to the letters, a hidden or a secret or a mystical number that is associated with that letter. It's always been there. It's never changed. The numbers are precise. They're very specific. They're very mysterious in terms of where they come from.
You mean if A has a number, B has a number?
Precisely. In the Hebrew language, one of the reasons that we chose biblical Hebrew, it is one of the, it's not the oldest language by any stretch of the imagination. Sumerian, Babylonian, Egyptian hieroglyphic, much older. However, the Hebrew, biblical Hebrews, is one of the oldest continuously used languages in human history, and it is a very stable language. It hasn't changed much in the last, at least the last 3,000 years, and probably the last 5,000 years.
All right.
So the numbers, there have always been very specific numbers linked to the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. We don't know where they came from. We haven't. And they haven't changed. Well, the what took 12 years to understand, and I'll make this very short, and we'll cut right to the chase, is that the elements of the periodic table, there are many different numbers, at least 17 different characteristics that describe the elements. We call them atomic weight, heat of fusion, electronegativity, all these technical sounding numbers. One and only one of the numbers that describes our modern periodic table also is precisely the number that's linked to the ancient Hebrew alphabet. And it's a very interesting characteristic. It's called atomic mass. The atomic mass number of the periodic table of elements, very specific elements, is the number that is also the number for those for the Hebrew letters.
How did you tie the two in together?
Well, what I did was I went into some of the most ancient Hebrew texts. Specifically, there is a very mystical text. It's called the Sefer Yetzirah. When people talk about the Kabbalah, there are three key texts in the Kabbalah. Two of them are very well known. They're called the Zohar and the Midrash. One of them has been translated into English very, very few times. Because it is so mystical, and it is called the Sefer Yetzirah, or literally the Book of Creation. And it's a relatively short book, about 1,000 lines long, as if an observer were watching God create the universe and the world and our bodies, and by literally following the texts, line by line, and the way that creation came about, those elements in the Hebrew language are linked with very specific numbers, and lo and behold, those numbers are linked to the elements of life.
Okay, right. But you still haven't told me how you put the two of them together.
Well, what we can do, and at the risk of sounding, I don't want to get too technical on the air, and,
no.
and I'm happy to go into as much detail as we need to here.
I mean, this isn't something you stumbled into, is it?
Well, it's something that we found. What we did was I was intentionally looking for this kind of information, and what we found was that the only four elements of life, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, and carbon, that make up the DNA in our bodies, are the only four elements, the atomic mass of those four elements are the only numbers that describe and are linked to the language in the Sefer Yetzirah describing the ancient name of God, and from that all things are made. So what we're looking at is the atomic mass number literally is the link, and from that atomic mass number, hydrogen takes on a very specific characteristic in the Hebrew alphabet, nitrogen takes on that characteristic, oxygen takes on that characteristic, carbon takes on that characteristic, and it's only with the atomic mass number that that these links are made. Those are the only numeric values that will work with both of those languages. Since we found this in Hebrew, it being the most complete language, we now know it works in other languages as well, such as ancient Arabic. The exact same link works in the Arabic language the way it works in the ancient Hebrew language.
And you're saying this code spells out God?
What we found, this was within every code, there's a primer. And the primer in this case was the ancient name of God. Once we were able to find how to spell the ancient name of God through the elements of the periodic table, we knew how the code worked. We could apply it then to other portions of the genetic code. And I'll just share with the audience right now precisely what in the introduction to each cell in every carbon-based life, at least the ones that we've studied so far, the literal language, the literal text translates to the words God eternal within the body. God eternal within the body. This is the introduction to the message in the cells in our bodies. The fact that that message is there has not been disputed by the scientists and the people that are reviewing this work. The controversy isn't over whether or not it's there, because once they see the numeric links, it exists. The controversy is coming from how it got there, who put it there, why it's there. We don't know from the message precisely who God is or how this message got there.
Well, what came first, the numeric code or the text? And of course, it was the code in the DNA that came first, obviously.
Well, it appears that it was, and then we have to ask ourselves how. So if the ancient Hebrew alphabet, if those letters of the alphabet are actually talking about the elements of life, how did they know to assign the numbers
precisely
to those letters that are precisely the atomic mass
unless
numbers?
They were told by somebody who knew what DNA was all about?
Well, that's the possibility that that many people are looking at right now.
Now, is it possible then that whoever might have genetically altered us also helped push the text a little bit?
We don't know who God eternal is, and I have to be very, again, as a scientist looking at this, the fact that we can consider biology as a language is just off the scale in terms of the way we've looked at things in the past. Taking that one step further, the fact that the first level of this code spells, admittedly, a very brief sentence, but a very potent sentence, God eternal within the body. One of the first things I did was went to the some of my statistician friends to find out what were the odds that this could happen by chance. You know, if you take enough letters out of a War and Peace or a phone book, you're going to eventually come up with something. And what they told me was, and the way they ran the statistics, that there is it's a 0.00042% probability that this message is a random, could be randomly formed. Which isn't an astronomical possibility, but there's enough there that suggests that this is intentional. It is a short message. God eternal within the body is a short message. As we go down to the deeper layers, the sentences become literally, George, we can now delineate the beginning and the end of a sentence. While we may not know what it says, we know where the sentences exist, and they are hundreds of letters long, and as those sentences are translated, the odds should increase geometrically and may become almost astronomical.
Have you gotten other messages beyond just this one?
This is the only one that I am no expert in genetics, in linguistics, or in microbiology. I put this algorithm together. We applied it to the genome. Then I had to seek out experts in the respective fields to validate and confirm or show me where I was thinking about this wrong. And that was a laborious process. It took many months to find people willing to do that. Once that was done, I'm absolutely certain of the first layer. That process is still ongoing with the subsequent layers, and we're still looking at the codes.
What happens, what would have happened had you not picked the Hebrew alphabet?
The message, it exists in other alphabets. The key is that Hebrew, and again, ancient biblical Hebrew, it's the oldest continuously used language, and also the records are the most complete. And there's something about this Hebrew language. It comes up again and again in the Bible code, in the code that we're working now, in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's something about the Hebrew language. It is what's considered a root or a core language. It wasn't derived from or an original language. It wasn't derived from other languages the way the English was, for example.
Well, whatever possessed you in the first place, Greg, to even think about looking into the DNA and looking for a code?
Well, George, I think, and again, this my time in the defense industry during the last years of the Cold War, I think probably influenced this tremendously. Those listeners who have either read or worked in the industry during that time know how frightening that time was and how very, very close the powers that be came to unleashing the weapons that we have in a way that is just almost unthinkable in our world today. And the sense is, and a lot of the colleagues I worked with, our feeling was if we could find a principle that was so universal that it included everyone, no one is excluded, that regardless of belief or lifestyle or heritage or bloodlines or borders, a principle that touched everyone with a message reminding us that we are, in fact, a family, and that there is something that brings us together that transcends the things that have separated us in the past, that maybe, just maybe, that would be a place to begin, a reason. As a logic-based society, we need a good reason to look at ourselves differently, and that may be a place to begin, that reason.
Well, did you look at other things first before you came upon DNA?
Well, I did, George, and as a scientist, this is back in the 80s. I began looking in the world around me. I began, we've been 18 years, looking into the temples, the texts of Egypt, the monasteries in the highlands of central China and Tibet. We've been through the ancient Hindu traditions, Nepal, we've just gotten back from India, and all through the Andes Mountains of Bolivia and Peru, through the desert southwest, and the Dead Sea Scrolls that we spoke of earlier, and all of them, George, as interesting as they have been, none of them showed us what we needed, and they all said essentially the same thing. They said, stop looking in the world out here, because what you're looking for, you're going to find within.
Well, the code is God eternal within the body, and what does that mean? So we'll be back in a moment with our guest Greg Braden on Coast to Coast AM.
Subscribe to the After Dark newsletter and reserve your free CD of Art Bell and the late Father Malachi Martin. 888-727-5505. from somewhere out there. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
So the message, according to Greg Braden, is God eternal within the body. But what does that all mean? We'll be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Greg, is the methodology in the book, The God Code, in terms of how you did the deciphering?
It is, George. The book's divided into three sections in a very readable format. My mom read the book in about 4 hours, she told me. The first section is the context, much of what we talked about in our first hour tonight, the lost texts, the condition we find ourselves in the world today, and why this message is important. The middle section describes precisely the links, the methodology, my thought processes, and the charts will show very, very specifically how these language linkages occur along the strands of DNA. The last section is the applications. What does it mean in our lives? So we covered a lot of ground in this last 90 minutes, and I just like to just reiterate very, very briefly precisely how this code works, because it's important for the listeners to understand we don't have to jiggle a number here or fudge mm-hmm. something there.
And why that message, God and, eternal within the body, if
well,
you'd explain
precisely, that. When we look at a strand of DNA, the DNA is made of fundamental, we're called the elements of life, primarily carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and each of those elements has at least 17 different characteristics that describe it. And every one of those characteristics is a number. So a lot of the 12 years was finding which number links it to the alphabets. But the key here is when we convert those elements into the number for the atomic mass, then the carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen all become described as numbers, as atomic mass. If we simply take that number and match it to the very precise, very specific number that has been with the ancient alphabets for 5,000 years, it tells us which letter to plug into that part of our DNA. And lo and behold, those are the letters that begin to spell words and the words that begin to spell the sentence.
Now, what language did it spell out God eternal within the body? Did it
The very first language is Biblical Hebrew.
Okay, so that's the language it also spelled this out, not English or anything like that.
Precisely. And it also spelled, now that we know how it works in Biblical Hebrew, it was easier to do it in that language. Now we're able to branch off. I have not tried every... his life has been a whirlwind since this whole thing has happened. We know, and I write about this in the book, it also works in Arabic. And I think it is such a beautiful symmetry that the same message works in both Hebrew and Arabic. And the implications, I think, are obvious for the conditions of our world today and specifically the Middle East. The same message exists in the bodies of both people in their own respective languages. It appears that it will also work in other root languages. We're looking at Sanskrit right now. But we know for certain, and I wrote the last chapter of the book talks about this, the last section, that it is in Hebrew and Arabic. It appears, George, that they work only in what are called the core or the root or the original languages, not in the later languages that were made by combining other alphabets.
What do you think this wording, God eternal within the body, means?
At the very least, what it says to me, it says that the message is intentional. It is a statistically significant combination of words. It says that at the very least that we're here on purpose, that there is an intelligence underlying our existence, although we may not know how it happened or who that intelligence is. It says at the very least that we're part of one another, we're part of all life, and very probably part of something greater. And it says that, at the very least that we are in fact part of one another, and it gives us a reason to work beyond the differences that may have separated us in the past.
There must be somewhere in this code, Greg, a rationale for the timetable when they expected or God expected, okay, whomever did this, could have been alien intervention, who knows right now.
Right.
But there must have been a timetable when they decided that when mankind can break this code, albeit 2003, 2004 when you did this, when mankind can break this code, they are then at a point in their existence when X, Y, and Z should occur, or maybe we can reveal something else. There's got to be some undertone here. When this code was finally broken, there's got to be more than just the message.
Well, there is, and as we go, and this is why I'm emphasizing this, the message we're sharing tonight is the one piece that has been validated and confirmed by experts in their respective fields. It is a brief message. It is the first layer, the introduction, if you will, into the book of the cells in our bodies. There are additional layers that are literally hundreds of letters long, and I think as we get down into those, although they aren't all confirmed yet, I think each of the chromosomes is going to tell us something a little different, a different aspect of who we are and perhaps where we've been. The reason I think the context within which we're finding this message now, historians looking back at the 20th century, George, the last 100 years, what they're saying to us is that as a species, between 1900 and 1999, we lived through the single bloodiest century in all of recorded human history on a per capita basis, bar none.
And also the most dramatic.
Precisely. Bloodier than anything that happened during the time of the Romans, during the Inquisitions. And they said that more people on a per capita basis lost their lives at the hands of other people than to all the natural disasters, all the disease combined, and that the loss of life was based on the perceived differences. Just because people were different from one another, their skin color was different, their religions were different, their borders, their heritage, their bloodlines. And the reason that's important is because in the first 3 years of the 21st century, the thinking that led to those frightening statistics is still in place. What historians are saying to us now, if they extrapolate based on what's happened in the first 3 years of this century, that if it continues, the 21st century will make those numbers pale by comparison. At the same time, some of the leading thinkers, I've had the opportunity to be in a number of conferences and panels, some of the leading engineers, social architects, thinkers, as well as religious leaders of our time, while they disagree on a lot of things, what they agree upon is the next 10 or 15 years are some of the most critical right now because of our propensity to solve our problems through war and to use the advanced technology that we have in that war. So the implications of this message are vast. When we can talk about genetics and evolution and biology and theology, and I certainly acknowledge all of those things, and for me, the overriding message that we're having right now is that we've got to get through, as a family, we've got to get through this next 10 to 15 years, and then we can go back and maybe look at some of these other implications. This message, the universal nature of this message gives us a reason to look at ourselves differently. And as I was researching the book, George, the statistics, the reality of the statistics surprised me. What I didn't know is that over one half of the world's nations are right now are engaged in war. They're not all declared war. Some of them are simply called conflicts, and people are losing their lives. The United States has boots on the ground. We've got troops in at least 22 different countries right now, and that it is these conflicts, isolated conflicts, that merge into regional conflicts and threaten the stability of our world today. The World Watch Institute's identified this in their State of the World surveys in 1999.
Well, from 1900 to 1999, when you think of how many deaths there might have been in World War I, World War II, the Holocaust involved in that, what Stalin did in Russia, what the Chinese have done, the Korean War, Vietnam, all the other atrocities on this planet. I bet you're dealing with 100 million people, easy, don't you think?
We're dealing with many more of those, and actually the chart is in the first section of the book, in within the first chapter of the book. We know at least 80 million people were lost, not counting war. They were simply lost to genocide alone. The United Nations had to actually coin a term to make genocide illegal. They had to coin the term ethnic cleansing and genocide to make it illegal, the right of denial of entire groups of people. And I'm amazed, as we share this with live audiences, people, we share the statistics, people say, okay, you know, that happened. Why is it important now? It's important because the thinking is still in place that allowed and led to those kinds of statistics. And we now have the ability, through our technology, to eliminate huge numbers of people in a single day, and we're willing to do that based on our differences. And whether we're talking about ancient prophecies, or we're talking about scientists and engineers, or we're talking about social architects looking down the road, all of them agree that humankind is the single greatest threat to our survival over these next 10 to 15 years.
Are you an end-time believer?
You know, I'm an optimist, and I believe that we're living a unique time in our history. Almost universally, ancient texts and traditions in their own way point to this time, whether we're talking about Mayan calendars or Egyptian calendars, or we're talking about oral prophecies. They say something unique is happening now. As a former geologist, well, my mom says once you're a geologist, you're always a geologist. So a former practicing geologist, what I know is that there are physical changes happening in the Earth now that we have not seen for a very long time, and maybe those two phenomena are converging, giving us the opportunity to identify this as a very unique time in history. And at the same time, George, Western physics, quantum science, now is saying that we're not simply observers, that we are participants, and that the way we live our lives, the choices we make, is directly mirrored in the effects of the world around us. And very, very good science, good statistics to back that up. So I believe that this is a pivotal point in human as well as Earth history, and I think the fact that this message exists says to us, it gives us a reason to look at ourselves differently, at the very least, and maybe look beyond the differences that have separated us in the past.
You write about Michio Kaku in your book, The God Code, and I do agree with him when he says that we may do some incredible things in the future in terms of time travel and everything else, but we have to get away from fossil fuels and we may blow ourselves up.
Well, I've had the honor of sharing the stage with Dr. Michio Kaku a number of times, a brilliant, he's co-author of the superstring theory.
Yes.
And what he says, he, in his book Visions, it was published in 1998, he interviewed 125 leading scientists and asked them what they saw for their future, and all of them were so empowering and so optimistic for the future, and all of them said yes, and for us to get there, we've got to get through our propensity for solving war or solving our problems through war and the violent competition over the resources that are leading to those kinds of wars. So they're supporting what many of the panels and the conferences and the ancient traditions have said. You know, George, it's so interesting. The book is out for review, and it's been out for review since last fall. Scientists and engineers who have had the opportunity to review this book, their reactions have been almost predictable, because almost to a person, the first thing those I've had the opportunity to interact with personally, what they say to me, the first thing they say is, Greg, there's no way that this could be. There's no way that biology could become a language, that there could be a code in ourselves. And almost in the same sentence, they look at me and they say, really? You know, is it really there? And then the scientist, the curiosity of a scientist kicks in and they say, show me how this works. And once they see the precision, the very specific way through this curious property that we call atomic mass, the atomic mass numbers that we give to the elements appear to be the mysterious numbers that were assigned to letters a long time ago. We don't know how or why that happened.
See, but I would ask the question, why the message? You know, I don't doubt the fact that it's not there.
Well,
but why?
Well, this is what happens. So the controversy is not over whether, this is so interesting to me. The controversy is not over whether or not it's there, because once you do the substitutions, it's there. The controversy is, where did it come from?
Yes.
Why is there? How could we have missed it for so long?
I don't think we were ready for it.
Well, I think the reason we missed it, George, and as exciting as this is for me to be able to share the message, what may be even more exciting is the fact that it is only by moving beyond the traditional boundaries that have separated the sciences in the past. That's the only way we could ever find this message, by looking at biology differently and linguistics, genetics, and by allowing ourselves to unify the world that science has separated in the last 400 years. The fruit of that labor is that we get to see our world in a new way, and I think it may just be the beginning. To me, that is very, very exciting.
Well, but didn't you have to know about DNA first, though, before you could decode?
I have a background, oceanography and life sciences, as well as the computer and the physical.
Well, I mean mankind in general.
Well, I think so. What science has done, science and the scientific method, and I subscribe to both, they're only about 400 years old. And in the last 400 years, what science has done is to compartmentalize nature and our physical world so that we can study and master each of those compartmentalized ideas, like geology and biology and chemistry and physics. And we've done that very well. And now that we understand how they work individually, I think our challenge is to marry those understandings into the wisdom of how our world truly works, because our world isn't separated. It's one interconnected, continuous organism, and all of these sciences work together. And that is simply what we've done to find this message.
Do you think this code will eventually tell us how or where we came from?
Well, let me put it this way. The genetic information encoded into that Neanderthal infant, into human chromosome 2, they contain the genetic history. Scientists can see where the splices and the fusions have occurred on a physical level. I would imagine that what we're seeing on the physical level is mirrored in the text as well. Part of my job when I was in the computer industry was with pattern recognition. And that was what led to, for me personally, to this search, because when you look at the genome, it looks like the pattern of a language, except we just don't know what it says. But you see places, delimiters, that tell where the codes begin, where the codes end. They act like sentences, except it's in a language we've never understood. And that is essentially what led to the investigation that 12 years later we found this first key. The thing that's so interesting is that each layer of the code has its own key. So just because you find one doesn't mean you have the whole message.
You're pretty well convinced, though, that we were not genetically altered from Neanderthals, right?
I am convinced simply because the DNA evidence shows us that, and the fossil evidence shows that, in fact, we shared the Earth with them. We find our fossils and their fossils in the same strata. So we couldn't have evolved from them. However, the evidence and the study that we shared earlier about human chromosome 2, genetic scientists are saying that at least a part of our genome, specifically chromosome 2, is what it is because ancient primate DNA was fused. They don't say who or how. They just say this is what happened.
Well, which means then that we were either fused with, as you said earlier, possibly apes. We bypassed Neanderthals, or they just plopped down modern human beings the way we are now.
Matter is what the evidence is suggesting, although we don't know how it happened.
All right, we'll be back. We'll take phone calls next hour with my guest, Greg Braden, the God Code, and a few more questions from me. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Find out more about tonight's guest, log on to coasttocoastam.com. Call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
So I wonder what else the God Code might show down the line, I hope they're good things for us. I'll be back with Greg Braden and your phone calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Greg, you said you're upbeat, positive about these messages and the outcome. Did you ever do any work into the Mayan calendar and its supposed 2012 ending date?
I have, George. I've looked into the Mayan calendar, the Egyptian calendar, the Aboriginal systems of timekeeping. And what they all point to this window of time, not necessarily some people interpret them with a specific date, but they point to this window of time that many of the experts are actually looking at right now. And they all say that this is a time of choice. From the Hopi traditions to many of the interpretations of the Mayan calendar, what they say is we're in a point in human and earth history where systems are becoming unstable. And it's within that instability that we have the opportunity to choose how we conduct our lives as people, and from that perspective, where our path leads us collectively. So what the Mayan calendar says is they don't measure time after the 2012 point on the calendar. They said because time is going to mean something very, very different to us.
And now, are these windows all around the same period?
They are. That's what makes it so interesting.
Yeah.
We're actually living the window that opened up. Depending on whose system of timekeeping you're looking at, it opened up the mid-70s through the year 2012.
Let's go to the calls. You ready?
I am, and I might need you to help me Sometimes it's hard for me to hear those callers, so if you'll repeat that question, that will help me.
All right, well, let's try a couple. You tell me how you hear it, and if you need help, I'll jump in for you, okay?
Thank you.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. Excuse me, hi.
Sure, I thought for a moment I was going to have to definitely help him with a phone.
I'm sorry.
All right.
Yeah, George, and yeah, it's real nice to talk to you and Greg, and... Anyway, this is Douglas. I'm calling from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, WMT 600.
Absolutely. Hi, Douglas.
Hi. What I was wondering is, has he, Greg, have you ever talked to Dr. Bollinger?
Well, good evening, Douglas. Thanks for calling. And to the best of my knowledge, I have not spoken with Dr. Bollinger.
All right. He proofread the Maserat, and... he found that it was definitive, and no matter what language it was written in or recorded in, be it Hebrew, Aramaic, or Greek, it was sort of a Rosetta Stone, and that it was definitive, and it eliminates any confusion, and didn't allow for any misinterpretation. And I was just wondering if you'd maybe read anything on him or...
I have not, and that certainly doesn't is in no way an indication of the validity of his work. We've just been so inundated with the material with his research. I have not had the opportunity to read a lot of other people's work. But what you're saying to me, this is one of the reasons a message in ourselves is so exciting, because it has not been suppressed, it has not been translated or edited through. A governing organization. Everyone carries the, according to scientists, 50 trillion cells in our bodies. We've got 50 trillion records of this message per human body. So, and it's the same, at least the upper levels of the message appear to be the same with everyone. So the good, clean message, I think, is very exciting for me.
Very good. Thanks for that call, Douglas. Appreciate it. First time caller line, you're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi.
Yes, sir.
I'm a big fan, Greg. I've been following you for years, way back from Zero Point. And I have a quick question. This is fascinating data and research that you've done, obviously, and I can't wait to dig into the book a little. Could you provide a specific example of the a specific atomic weight of an element and how it relates to a specific Hebrew letter. That part's a little confusing. Like for instance, if carbon weighs 1.063, are you suggesting that a Hebrew letter can be, has that exact same value of like 1.063? Is that how it works?
Make it as non-technical as you can, Greg.
Sure. Well, what we're doing is there are specific rules that are applied to working with ancient languages, and if we are consistent and we apply the same rules to the periodic table of elements that we apply to ancient languages, and if we do the same thing vice versa, if we apply the same rules to the periodic table that we do the ancient languages, then that's the way these numbers work. So, for example, and again, this is atomic mass, not atomic weight, and there is a difference, although some people use them interchangeably. The atomic mass of hydrogen, for example, is 1.008. In the ancient languages, they use only the whole number portion. That's what we call the integer, everything to the left of the decimal. So in the ancient languages, hydrogen is represented as the number one. When we go into the Hebrew alphabet, the first place we find the one is with a very mysterious letter called Aleph. It's a silent letter. It's not used. So we go to the next letter down, which is the Hebrew letter Yud, the first letter of God's name, and that is a precise example of where that atomic mass is pointing directly to the first letter of the message in the cells of our bodies.
All the past civilizations that you investigated, Greg, do they all seem to have similar messages?
Well, they do, and this is the interesting thing, is that if we are in fact speaking about alphabets and languages, they're different languages describing the same things, the alphabets change, the numbers do not. So if in fact these mysterious numbers that are linked to the ancient alphabets are actually what today we call atomic mass, then that's the common denominator. The numbers don't change over time, only the meaning that we give to the letters.
All right, wild card line, welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Hi, Greg. John, St. Louis.
Oh, hi, John. Well, how are you?
Good evening, John. Thanks for calling.
It's amazing work. And I've been reading a series of books that says the new gospel is that we are all one, and that my way is not a better way, it's just another way. Do you believe that the human race can survive as a species if we do not adopt this philosophy of respect for each other's religions?
I believe implicitly in the wisdom of our of humankind collectively. We're embarking upon a path right now. We have that looks to be very precarious, very dangerous. And I think the path is leading us to the understanding that cooperation rather than violent competition is the way that we're going to survive what scientists are calling the greatest challenges of recorded human history. So if we continue with violent competition, I think we're going to have a pretty tough time. I think that what we're learning is that it is cooperation, and sociologists, natural scientists are telling us that in every other species of nature, bar none, every other species, that cooperation ensures the survival of the species, and that violent competition is detrimental to the species. And we have to ask ourselves, are we so much different than the rest of the natural world?
At any point, does any of this talk about natural disasters that hit us?
Even in the natural disasters, what the researchers, the committees, the panels, the studies that were done, we just came through the end of a millennium, and there were a number of committees and panels that convened to discuss what we can expect over the next millennium, what we can expect over the next 100 years. And they looked at good things as well as the dangers. And the dangers they identified, George, you know, asteroid impacts, certainly the tsunamis that we've heard about, disease. And as significant as all of those were, they all agreed the greatest threat to our survival was ourselves, and our propensity to solve our problems.
Well, and that's the most real, and it's right out there for all of us to see, I think. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah.
Hi, it's Tina. How are you?
Hi, Tina. Fine.
You guys are wonderful. I've always wanted to know everything, why everything, since I'm a little kid. And I've been researching the last year or so some answers to some questions regarding Christianity and Buddhism. And I've been reading Whitley Strieber and Jalayla Starr. She wrote We Are the Nibiruans.
Right.
And Barbara Marciniak, you know, Pleiadian information. Phyllis Schlemmer, The Only Planet of Choice. And what Greg is talking about tonight, about scientific evidence regarding our genetic recoding of our DNA, that's what Jalayla Starr said in her book, We Are the Nibiruans, that they did thousands of years ago, and that they're here to help us ascend again.
And Zechariah Sitchin indeed did the same thing. So
right.
There's a lot of similarities here.
Right. And when you gave the phrase, Greg, God eternal within the body, am I saying it correctly?
Yes.
That is precisely the that's the message in the first layer of ourselves.
Oh, it's incredible. Because did you guys hear a few years ago when scientists weighed the human body and there was an advanced scale that gave a minuscule drop in weight when a person died?
Certainly. They were done on atomic scales, and it's about 0.28 grams is what that weight is.
Thank you. As a nurse for 20 years, I recall, you know, the first time I had to walk into a room where someone had died, and I could still feel the energy of that person. I wanted to know, where did they go, you know? And then I became a Buddhist, and then I started to study, you know, that that life is eternal. And the only difference between an enlightened entity, a Buddha, or if you want to say a Christ, and a common mortal is in our illusions and delusions.
Well, precisely, Gina. I think the beauty of what we're going to find with this language is that this message, whoever put it there, however it originated, it began long before any religions were ever built around this kind of information. It transcends those religions. And, George, one of the things that's been interesting is the spiritual and religious leaders that have contacted me since the book has been released. While their respective beliefs are very different, they each have said to me that this discovery supports what they profess in their traditions. And I think it's interesting, and it says that we have cut through many of the of the rules and maybe some of the dogma to something much more basic, a much more basic truth, perhaps.
The 1907 was when the research was done, by the way, on how much does a soul weigh, by a doctor who studied six people who were about ready to die, and he had them on scales before their death, and is totally convinced that they did not lose bodily fluids or anything like that.
Right.
But they did lose, as you said, that percentage of grams weight.
So this, the first studies that you're aware of were 1907?
1907, yes.
Oh, okay.
It went back a long time ago. He proved the point. Next up, International Line, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, am I on?
You are.
Wow, this is a great honor, George. Calling from Toronto.
Hi there.
Canada. It's Alan. Actually, I come from an Orthodox Jewish background. My father was a rabbi, and we probably go back rabbis probably to the time of Jesus, time of the temple.
That's a long time.
Yeah. So I'm actually, my father's originally from Israel, Palestine at the time.
Uh-huh.
We're fluent in Hebrew, and that means I can pick up a Talmud and read it in the original. Unfortunately, growing up and being in an Orthodox crowd, they even studying Kabbalah is not always recommended till you're 40 and married, etc. But I've, you know, read certain parts, and especially with prophecies. I was just going to add what the other caller said. I mean, I've been hearing for years in Jewish writings about how DNA is very much linked with our tradition. I'm just looking up here on a Kabbalah website. And actually a chat they're having about one thing which is very interesting. It says at the end of times, mercy and judgment, woe and blessing, or cause and effect will happen almost immediately. I mean, as far as the end of times, from people in, let's say, in the Orthodox Jewish community who've really studied it, and all you have to do is pick up even the English versions of the Talmud, you have such clear signs. I mean, I'll just say one thing, and I'm not trying to proselytize anyone here, but the Talmud, for example, says that you have no clearer sign that the Talmud was written, of course, in the time of Jesus.
Right,
you have no
right.
clearer sign that the end of times, and that can be a 300-year period, whatever, no clearer sign than the sprouting of trees, something to that effect, in the land of Israel, meaning and the people of Israel coming back to their land. The Talmud talks about there are statements in 1948 the Israel will stand up, that the Western Wall will never be destroyed. But there are, unfortunately, whether it's Christian way of looking at it or the traditional Jewish, there's definitely a we're at a crossroads here, because we don't believe that Armageddon is a definite thing. It's something that can be prevented.
Can be prevented. Right.
Right. But God is quite specific that people have to repent. And I'm not really religious like I used to be, but I will say that when you look at the world around us, when you think of the tremendous wealth, whether here in Canada or in the U.S., and then you think of the amount of money that is made off of filth, and then you think about that at one end of the world right now, every day, 7,000-8,000 kids are dying. I would think that in the heavens, it's not a good... they're not looking too good upon it.
Well, and so, I would agree with you, Alan. I don't think we're at a point yet where we've changed it, where things will get better for us. Greg, what do you think?
Well, this is the I think the beauty of In a left-brain, logic-based society, we appear to need a reason to change the way we live our lives, to change the way we believe, and to change the way we think about ourselves. Other cultures that I've visited do not need this reason. They're simply willing to do it based on what they feel in their bodies and their hearts. But we don't work that way. So I think that the fact that that Western science, through the best science of our time, married with an ancient wisdom, is showing us the beginnings of a text-based message in the cells of our bodies. It gives us a good reason to think about ourselves differently. And at the same time, the prophecies, whether we're talking about Navajo or Hopi, or we're talking about Aboriginal, or even the Bible code based on the Torah, they're all very clear that they see possibilities only. They do not tell us what will happen. They say these are the things that may happen.
But I'm telling you, the possibilities are horrible.
They are, and we are participating. It's not like we're bystanders. We are active participants. The way we choose to live our lives and think about one another, individually and collectively, determine those outcomes. So through this message, we're given a very good reason. If we'd like to hang our reason for thinking differently on something, we now have a very good reason to do that.
Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. Dr. Greg Braden, my guest. I'm George Norrie.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505.
Angel.
George Norrie, call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Our next Coast to Coast program, my guest will be Sylvia Brown. That's right, legendary psychic. She'll be back on the show, so make sure you're part of that program. The March issue of the After Dark newsletter, make sure you're part of that as well, because when you call this number and order it, 1-888-727-5505 or coasttocoastam.com right off the website, you'll get a free CD, one of Art Bell's earlier interviews with the late father, Malachi Martin. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Greg Braden, my guest, and your phone calls as well. The God Code, where do you get it, Greg?
It is available wherever books are sold, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. You can get it through our website. I think you can get it through your website as well.
Absolutely. You've got it, and it's out there on the market. And like you said, it came out November-ish?
It came, actually, the book was released... It was scheduled to be released in February. It was pre-released in December. And,
they leaked it to the public, huh?
They leaked it a little before time, and is doing very well right now.
What part of the DNA is being analyzed for the wording? How did you do that?
This is when we look into the genome. Every cell of our bodies has essentially it's in. Multiple layers. It's a challenge to do this without the charts and the graphs, but it's the information is encoded in multiple layers. And what we're looking at now is this is just like the top layer. It's the entrance. It's the opening. And as the algorithms are being developed, we're looking at probably mid to late summer. We'll begin running the entire chromosomes, the entire genome, chromosome at a time, through the algorithms and. As soon as we know more, I'm happy to share it with you, George. I'd love to be able to share what's deeper in these codes.
Very good. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome. You are on the air. Hi.
Hi, Mr. Norrie. Hi, Greg.
Yes, sir.
Good evening.
My question is about Down syndrome and the extra chromosome. If you have any scientific knowledge on that with your study.
I'm not a doctor of medicine, and I don't have anything specifically. But what you were talking about right now is one of the things that we are so excited about with this discovery, because as we're able to decode the deeper layers of our genome, when we run into DNA that that expresses itself with Down syndrome or with sickle cell anemia or something like that, we may actually be able to have a dialogue with the cells. In other words, we're going to see precisely what that combination of genes says to us in a text-based language. So while we may intuit now what these conditions mean in our bodies, and while medicine tells us what they mean chemically, we're looking at the possibility of actually having a dialogue with our body through a language that we recognize.
Okay,
the implications are just vast.
All right, thanks. Appreciate that phone call. With the work you've done, and as you've said, Greg, that you're not nearly finished, how much work do you have to do yet?
Well, George, right now we don't know how many layers this code involves. We know it's multiple layers, and whoever... I had someone in a live audience this last week ask me, why did whoever put this code there, why did they make it so hard for us to find it? And the fact is, it is very simple and it's very eloquent. The reason it's taken so long that we're challenged the way we are is that we must first overcome our judgment and our bias of the way we believe our world works. So as we are willing to do that, as we're willing to go beyond these traditional boundaries, the way the codes work is kind of popping out, and each layer has its own unique code. So just because we have one doesn't guarantee we have another one.
Well, that's true, too. I hate to think, though, that it ends with just one. But the one, God eternal within the body, it's pretty darn interesting anyway, huh?
Well, it is, George. I mean, the implications, the fact that a message is there at all is just absolutely mind-boggling. And then the fact that the words, when we put those words together, the meaning that they convey just carries that another magnitude beyond. You know, before his death in 1996, Carl Sagan was very active with the SETI program,
yes.
Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And he was asked by the Senate to justify the expenditures. Why is it worthwhile to look for signs of life from beyond our world. And what he said was, he said, even if we never find anything, he said, just the effort would have such a cohesive effect on the whole of humankind. Just the effort of working together to find this, in a very real sense, the signature of an intelligent force at the very core of life is a message from somewhere in our past and very possibly from beyond our world. And if Sagan was even partially correct, the implications are just staggering and the possibilities are exhilarating.
Wild Card Line, you're on Coast to Coast with Greg Braden. Hi there.
Hey, George, how you doing?
I'm doing wonderful, thank you.
This is Jerry in Pennsylvania. How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing well. Thank you for your call this morning.
Yep, I would like to hear what Michio Kaku has to say about your theory there. And I hear the saying that God said help the needy, not the greedy. Now, this man is obviously a religious man, Greg, and I find it fascinating how ironic it is. What he's saying is so similar to the Luciferian guy that Art had on a few days ago. Their predictions seem to be very similar. They both speak about this fight to the death over the world's resources, which seems inevitable. And your guest, Greg, makes the analogy of nature, the struggle in nature where animals have to cooperate to exist or survive. But I personally am pretty cynical about the ruling class and the elite that are ruling this country and the rest of the world, whether or not they really want to cooperate with the middle and lower classes to keep us as a species alive. And I was wondering what he thinks about that.
Good point, Jerry. I'll let you listen on the radio. What he's talking about, Greg, of course, is always what a lot of us have thought, is that this power group within this planet really wants to depopulize the planet and depopulate it to the point where, you know, there may be only 500 million people, not 6 billion.
Sure, sure.
And they really don't care about solving the problems that the codes like this warn us.
Certainly. I did not have the opportunity to hear the earlier guest that he was speaking about, so I can't comment on that. What I can comment on is the statement you're making right now, George. What we know, and this is the previous book, the Isaiah Effect addresses this directly, what I'm about to share. Western science, between 1993 and in the end of the decade, validated and confirmed the existence of a previously unrecognized field of energy. It's a non-conventional form of energy that links all of creation. And what they say is that this field of energy is everywhere all the time. It's been here from the time of the Big Bang. And the key is that this field of energy is intelligent. It responds to very specific kinds of human emotions. What this field of energy tells us, George, is that although we like to characterize our world as them and us, it says there is no them and us. It says there is a we. And statistically, the research, the science has shown, is that as we adopt new belief systems, as we change the way as individuals in our families and our communities, the way we live our lives, the way we think, the way we believe, that effect carries far beyond our families and our communities, and is a catalyst for social change. So while it's easy to be cynical, and I find myself having that challenge at times as well, what the best science of our day is suggesting, and what the traditions of the ancients say in very clear words, is simply that we must become as individuals what we'd like to see in our world, and by virtue of doing that, we allow it to become in our world as well.
West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Dan from Woodstock.
Hi, Dan.
I got a question. Do you think it's possible that the closer we get to solving, you know, the ancient riddle of life, the more boundaries this power puts up to weed out the non-believers? You know, could it all be like involved in an ancient faith-based idea of God? And it seems like the closer we get to solving these riddles, it seems like the more boundaries are put up. Just wanted your opinion on that.
Boundaries in what respect? How are you seeing the boundaries?
Well, I tie all this into my personal beliefs of a faith-based religion, meaning that the closer we get to solving these problems, or not, you know, these ideas of where's God from, is there a power greater than ourselves, it always seems that during that time that there's more riddles put up and more problems to solve. So we can only get so far. You know, there's only so much we're supposed to figure out.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Well, what I can say is this. When we study the ancient traditions that led to the religions, the traditions were there before the religions were ever there.
Right.
And when we go back far enough, as different as they appear, it appears that they stem from a common lineage of wisdom that goes back to the earliest traditions, you know, of humankind, as different as they appear today.
Right.
That they, you can follow them on a tree, and they appear to stem from a common wisdom. So I think what's happened is, over time, that wisdom, bits and pieces have been adopted, and they've been put into the dogma of the various beliefs that have served us, however well they've served us.
Right.
And if we'd like to go beyond all the red tape, if you will, what we're looking at is we are looking at facts that predate the religions. And that may be the unifying principle, because the religions tell us that we are different.
Right.
In many respects, the fact, and I think that is the beauty of this message, is that the fact that it exists no matter how we live our lives, no matter what our heritage or our beliefs or our bloodlines or borders are, the message exists. The fact that it exists, and we can now see it in both Hebrew and Arabic.
Right.
In the language of two people now who are so challenged to justify the existence of one another in their lands, the same message exists in each of their respective languages. And I think that's a powerful, powerful principle of unity. It doesn't mean that we can't fight. It means that our differences are no longer justification for those kinds of fights.
Right. It just seems to me that I have this innate feeling that there's only so far, so much we're going to be able to figure out until we die. I might be wrong, but it seems like, you know, there's only so far we can go. And, you know, like, I believe everything you're saying, you're going on the right track, but it's just that innate feeling that we will only know as much as the power greater than ourselves allows us to know until we die. But,
well,
you know,
that, I believe that, and I believe that the ancient tenet that says, look within, seek within and you shall find, all of those kinds of things. I think that the deeper we carry this message, I think the things that we're asking ourselves, literally, we've carried in the cells of our bodies, preserved and replicated for many thousands of years. And as we have the wisdom to get beyond our judgments and our beliefs, I think, while what you're saying may be true, I think there's a long way to go between what we know now and what that limit's going to be.
Thanks for your call. Let's go to our wild card line as the clock is ticking. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. It's
yes,
a pleasure to speak with both of you tonight.
Sure, thank you.
I'm a big fan of Dr. Braden. You mentioned in some of your earlier writings and texts that, which was I found was fascinating, that the Earth as an organism may actually be contributing to our evolution as a whole through you know, Schumann's resonance, the shifting electromagnetic pulse of the Earth combined with gravity, the shifts in gravitational fields. And I was wondering if that research has continued and how you think that may tie into this discussion as well. And I was also wondering, you mentioned some of the ancient tombs that you found where some of, like, the yogis would go and meditate within the different electromagnetic pulse so they could, you know, prepare for the future, through their reincarnated future. And I was wondering if these places are accessible and if I'd really like to go to one of them and meditate.
Can anybody go to these, Greg?
So, well, we did, and I have, and now it's a three-part question that we've just asked. what he's referring to is a work that was first published in 1988, and some of the earlier work that I did as an engineer. What I found, and the researchers that were working with me, was that quite literally thousands of years ago, temples were constructed then to simulate the conditions of our Earth right now. What we know is that the magnetic fields of the Earth are declining very, very rapidly. Other parameters are changing as well in our own backyard, in our living room. Thousands of years ago, it was not the case, however.
within the chambers of very specific temples. Some of them are in Egypt, some of them are in the American Desert Southwest. Individuals could go into those chambers. They would experience the simulation then of what Earth is living now. They knew what it felt like to their bodies, and they wrote to us in their text, and they said, this is how you manage these kinds of experiences in your bodies, and it all revolved around the principles we're discussing tonight through very simple words like love, compassion, forgiveness. Those kinds of emotions change the chemistry in our bodies. They change the magnetics in our bodies and allow us to tolerate these shifts in the ancient chambers. And if we can adopt what they left to us, now it allows us to change the way our bodies are responding to the world around us.
Boy, I can see the day, though, when this entire planet shifts. I hope it's not in our lifetime, Gregory.
Well, there is... Geologically, we know it's happened at least 14 times in the last 4.5 million years that the magnetics have dropped to zero. The last time was between 9 and 12,000 years ago in the geologic record. However, written texts suggest it may have happened as recently as 3,600 years ago, and it's too recent, so you wouldn't find that in the rock record. And if that is the case, and if this is cyclic, and the evidence suggests that we are actually living a cycle right now where the magnetics are declining very rapidly. They're at the lowest point they've been in the last 2,000 years. That correlates with what we spoke of earlier, the ancient calendars as well as the written text. So all the evidence, whether we're looking at cultural, mythological, or scientific data, they all say that something unique is happening now.
I've got a scientist who's going to plot out a proposed Planet X elliptical orbit for me and tell me if it exists based on this graph, and that would be fascinating to find.
I wouldn't be surprised. According to the Hopi, that's precisely what happens every 3,600 years.
Yeah, just like by the way the Sumerians, and I find the relationship between what they say, the Hopis, of course, thousands of miles away from where the Sumerians were in Iraq, but they're all similar.
They're similar, and I've got to tell you, we were in Tibet, and there are records in the Tibetan monasteries of the Hopi in the American Desert Southwest, and vice versa, as well as texts that somehow were exchanged a long, long time ago. How they traveled and how they got there, and no one can really explain satisfactorily, but obviously it's happened.
Greg, thank you so much. The God Code, good luck. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being such a gracious host tonight, George.
Absolutely.
Take good care.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galanti, Dave Caprita, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, webmaster, Barbara Simpson, Art Bell. Special guest, by the way, Ian Punnett, Saturday for Art. Art's taking a weekend off. I'm George Norrie. Our next program, Sylvia Brown. Until then, be safe, everyone.